Scene 7. Apart from Richard's unnecessary roughness, opening night had gone well, and the following morning praises were lavished on us in the hallways. The choral and orchestral students remained aloof, unimpressed by anyone who didn't have the discipline for something so refined as music, but the others regarded us with wide-eyed admiration. How could we explain that standing on a stage and speaking someone else's words as if they are your own is less an act of bravery than a desperate lunge at mutual understanding? An attempt to forge that tenuous link between speaker and listener and communicate something, anything, of substance. Unable to articulate it, we simply accepted their compliments and congratulations with the appropriate, and in some cases entirely contrived, humility. In class, we were easily distracted. I barely listened to Frederick's lecture, and my mind wandered so far during one of Camilo's balance exercises that I let Philippa knock me over backward. Alexander gave me an impatient sort of look that clearly meant, "Get your shit together." As soon as we were dismissed, I retreated to the tower with a mug of tea and René Girard's Theater of Envy, hoping to distract myself from a dozen distressing premonitions of the night ahead. By then, I felt no sympathy for Richard. The relentless catch-all antagonism he'd practiced over the last few weeks left a deeper impression than 3 years of placid friendship had, but I knew that no retaliation on our part would go unpunished. Any impartial observer would have dismissed it as a grandiloquent grudge match, but when I tried to persuade myself that that was all it was, Frederick's voice quietly reminded me that duels had been fought over less. The prospective comeuppance of our feud with Richard, enormous as it loomed, was not the only thing weighing on my mind. Friday night was the night of the cast party. An hour after final curtain, most of Delacour's theater students and the bolder ones from other disciplines would invade the first floor of the castle to celebrate a good opening and drink to the coming close. Meredith and Wren, neither of whom appeared on stage after Act Two, had graciously agreed to sneak back between intermission and curtain call to get everything ready for a night of riotous revelry. When the rest of us arrived, we would have nothing to do but give our thanks to Dionysus and indulge. At 6:30, I closed my book and took the stairs down to the dining room. The table and chairs had already been cleared away to make enough space for a dance floor. A set of speakers, surreptitiously borrowed from the sound booth, was stacked in one corner, cables trailing along the baseboards toward the nearest outlets. I left the castle and began the long walk to the Fab with a fretful, anxious feeling that became more and more like dread with each passing minute. It must have been showing on my face by the time I opened the door to the dressing room, because Alexander grabbed the front of my jacket, hauled me out to the loading dock, and stuck a lit spliff in my mouth.
"Don't get jittery," he said. "Everything's going to be fine."
I'm not sure anyone has ever been so wrong. I puffed obediently on the spliff until there was only a half inch left. Alexander took it, sucked it down to his fingertips, threw it on the ground, and led me back inside. My misgivings faded to a vague paranoia at the back of my brain. Time moved slowly as I put on makeup and costume pieces and went through the motions of a vocal warm-up. James, Alexander, Wren, Philippa and I leaned on the wall in the crossover, hands splayed on our diaphragms, chanting, "Howl, howl, 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 oh, you are men of stones." When a first year with a headset appeared to tell us we had 5 minutes to places, my personal time lag collapsed, and everything started to move as if on fast forward. The second years vacated the dressing rooms and scrambled to find their places in the wings, hastily buttoning shirts and cuffs, or hopping down the hall as they tried to get their shoes tied. Philippa threw me in a chair in the girls' dressing room and attacked me with a comb and a tube of hair gel as the lights came up and the first lines of the play crackled through the backstage speakers. Flavius.
"Hence! Home, you idle creatures! Get you home! Is this a holiday?"
Philippa gave me a smart little slap to the forehead.
"Oliver."
"Fuck! What?"
"You're done," Get out of here, she said, scowling down at me, one hand on her hip. What is the matter with you? Sorry, I said as I climbed out of the chair. Thanks, Pip. Are you high? No. Are you full of crap? Yes. She pursed her lips and shook her head, but didn't reprimand me further. I wasn't entirely sober, but neither was I entirely stoned, and she probably knew that Alexander was mostly to blame. I left the girls' dressing room and loitered in the crossover until Richard brushed past, taking no more notice of me than he did of the paint on the walls. I followed a half-step behind him, emerged into the glaring lights, and said, with as much sincerity as I could muster, "Peace! Ho! Caesar speaks!" Acts 1 and 2 passed not unlike the first rainy front of a hurricane. There was rumble and bluster and a sense of impending peril, but we and the audience knew that the worst was yet to come. When Calpurnia entered, I watched from the edge of the wings. Richard and Meredith seemed to have overcome their difficulties, or had at least put them on hold for the duration of the run. He was rough with her, but not violent. She was impatient with him, but not provocative. Before I knew it, James was shaking me by the shoulder and whispering, "Let's go." Act 3 opened with the silhouette of the colonnade against the scrim, which glowed scarlet, a raw, dangerous dawn. Richard stood between the two center columns, the rest of us arranged in a ring around him, as Metellus Cimber knelt in the bowl and pleaded for his brother. I was standing closest, so close that I could see the tiny tick of a nerve in Richard's jaw. Alexander, waiting with predatory feline patience on the opposite side of the circle, caught my eye and flicked the front of his jacket open to reveal the paper knife tucked in his belt. They were more in keeping with the theme than daggers would have been, but no less threatening. Richard.
I could be well moved if I were as you. If I could pray to move, prayers would move me. But I am constant as the northern star, of whose true fixed and resting quality there is no fellow in the firmament.
He looked around at the rest of us with bright, gleaming eyes, daring us to contradict him. We shifted our feet and fingered our narrow blades, but kept our silence.
Richard, the skies are painted with unnumbered sparks. They are all fire, and every one doth shine, but there's but one in all doth hold his place. So in the world, 'tis furnished well with men, and men are flesh and blood and apprehensive. Yet in the number I do know but one, that unassailable holds on his rank, unshaked of motion, and that I am he.
His voice filled every corner of the auditorium like a crack opening in the earth's crust, the boom and tremor of an earthquake. On my right, Philippa raised her chin, just barely.
Richard, let me a little show it, even in this. That I was Constant Cimber should be banished, and Constant do remain to keep him so.
Cinna began to object, but I had no ears for him. My eyes were fixed on James and Alexander. They mirrored each other's movements, turning slightly downstage so the audience could see the steel glinting on their belts. I licked my bottom lip. Everything felt too close, too real, like I was sitting in the front row of a movie theater. I squeezed my eyes shut, fist clenched on the hilt of my knife, listening for the five fatal words that would spur me to action.
Richard. Doth not Brutus bootless kneel?
I opened my eyes, and all I saw was James, one knee bent in genuflection, staring up at Richard with bold contempt in his face.
Speak, hands, for me!
I shouted, and leapt at Richard, thrusting my blade under his upstage arm. The other conspirators came suddenly to life and swarmed on us like wasps. Richard glared at me, teeth bared and grinding hard together. I wrenched my knife away and made to move back, but he seized me by the collar, crushing the fabric so tightly around my throat that I couldn't breathe. I dropped the knife, groping at his wrist with both hands as his thumb jabbed into my carotid artery. My vision was already swimming when Richard released me with a roar of pain. Alexander had grabbed him by the hair and yanked him backward. I fell heavily on my tailbone, one hand flying to my neck. Someone had Richard's arm bent behind his back, and the other half-dozen conspirators lunged to take their stabs at him, all blocking abandoned. In the confusion, he lashed out wildly and hit Philippa right in the stomach, hard enough to knock her sprawling. She landed in a heap on the stairs. I'd made it to my feet just in time to watch her fall, and an inarticulate sound of outrage stuck in my throat. I shoved Cinna aside and dropped to my knees beside her. She lifted her head, clutching her stomach, gulping futilely, all the wind knocked out of her. Suddenly the bedlam subsided, and I turned halfway around, kneeling over Philippa, who was quiet but gripping my leg hard. Richard stood surrounded by panting conspirators, arms pinned to his sides, Alexander's fist still clenched in his hair. James stood just out of his reach, suit disheveled, knife clutched tightly in his hand. Richard's words were thick with hatred as he said,
"Et tu, Brute?"
James took one step forward and placed the blade against his neck. "Richard."
"Then fall, Caesar."
James's face was unnervingly blank. He slid the knife quickly forward. Richard made a short choking sound, then let his head loll against his chest. Alexander and the rest of the conspirators released him one by one, and he slumped to the floor. When they straightened up again, the second and third years looked from me to James to Alexander, wide-eyed, painfully aware of the audience and the fact that the scene had spiraled completely out of control. One of them had a line, but she must have forgotten because nobody spoke. Alexander waited as long as he could, then spoke for her.
"Liberty! Freedom! Tyranny is dead!"
He gave the nearest second year a small shove.
"Run hence! Proclaim! Cry it about the streets!"
The rest shifted, exhaled, relieved. Philippa gasped as the air rushed into her lungs again. I helped her sit halfway up while Alexander continued barking orders.
"Some to the common pulpits and cry out, liberty, freedom, and enfranchisement!"
"People and senators, be not affrighted," James said to the conspirators, and his calmness seemed to reassure them. "Fly not. Stand still. Ambition's debt is paid."
We relaxed into the text again as if nothing at all unusual had happened. But as Philippa and I climbed to our feet, I couldn't help glancing down at Richard. He lay motionless except for the angry twitch of his eyelids, a vein bulging and throbbing in his throat. Scene 8. My head cleared as Brutus and Cassius's coup collapsed. Richard had disappeared out the door during intermission, and no one saw him again until Act 4 when he returned as Caesar's ghost, an apparition doubly sinister for its stony solemnity. The final curtain fell at 10:30, and my body ached with fatigue, but the layered drama of the assassination scene and anticipation for the party kept me awake and alert. By the time I'd washed my face, gotten my costume off, and dressed myself again, most of the second and third years had gone. James and Alexander were waiting in the crossover with four fat spliffs rolled already, one for each of us and one for Philippa, who had already gone back to the castle to change. We left the fab and strolled down the path through the woods with our hands in our pockets. We didn't mention the 3-1 incident except for Alexander saying simply, "I hope he's learned his lesson." When we were only 30 feet from the castle, the sultry party light began to soak through the thick shadows of the trees. We stopped to finish smoking and stamped the roaches down in the damp pine needles. Alexander turned to us and said, "We've had a long week. I plan to make a long night of it, and if you two aren't royally fucked by midnight, I will take it upon myself to see that you are fucked, royally or otherwise, by morning. Understand?
Me. You make it sound a lot like date rape.
Alexander.
Do as I've said, and it won't come to that.
James.
You're both of you going to hell.
Alexander.
Directly.
Me.
Post haste.
Alexander.
Every man put himself into triumph. Some to dance, some to make bonfires, each man to what sport and revels his addiction leads him.
Go.
Obediently we went.
The front door opened and a wave of noise crashed out to meet us. The castle was crammed with people, some drinking, some dancing, sparkling in their party clothes. The boys didn't look too terribly different from usual, only better dressed, better groomed, but the girls were hardly recognizable. Night had fallen, and with it came short slinky dresses and dark mascara and satin lipstick, transforming them from mere girls to a coven of bewitching nocturnal creatures. The welcoming roar washed over us. Hands reached out to snatch our clothes and drag us helplessly inside. Two kegs sweated in the downstairs bathtub, tightly packed in with ice and bottles of water. Stacks of solo cups cluttered the kitchen counter, while handles of cheap rum, vodka, and whiskey were arranged in a bowling pin pyramid on the stove, mostly paid for by Meredith's exorbitant monthly allowance, with more modest contributions from the rest of us. The good stuff was stashed in Alexander's bedroom. As soon as we arrived, Philippa nipped upstairs and returned with a scotch and soda for each of us. Immediately thereafter, James and Alexander both disappeared, sucked away into the crowd. Most of the theater students had assembled in the kitchen, where they talked and laughed twice as loudly as they needed to, still performing, observed by less obnoxious onlookers from the art, language, and philosophy departments. Choral and orchestral students eager to criticize the music selection and dancers eager to show off had filled the dining room, which was so poorly lit that they either had only a dim idea who they were dancing with or simply didn't care. Music thundered through the floorboards, every bass note a tiny earthquake, the footstep of a slow approaching dinosaur. The surface of my drink shivered and vibrated until Philippa threw a handful of ice in it.
Thanks, I said.
Her expression was distant, distracted.
You okay?
Fine, she said with a pained sort of smile. Got a wicked bruise, but not where anyone will see.
You look good to me, I said lamely.
She wore a short blue something that showed off her long legs. Mercifully, she wasn't too made up and still looked human.
It happens every now and then, she said, exhaling, allowing herself to relax. Where have you been?
Outside. Alexander rolled you a spliff if you want it.
God bless the filthy hedonist. Where is he now?
On the dance floor, I said, prowling for first years who don't know they're gay yet.
Where else? She said,
and left the kitchen, deftly weaving between the people at the counter fighting to get a hold of the rapidly diminishing mixers. I took a long drink of scotch and soda, wondering how long the crossfade would take. Colin and several other third years paused on their way out to the driveway, where people would be smoking and chatting and waiting for their eardrums to stop throbbing, to congratulate me on a good show. I thanked them, and when they filed out, Colin hovered on the threshold. I bent my head close to his to hear him.
3-1 went off the rails today, he said. Everything all right?
I think so, I said. Pip got knocked around a bit, but she's tough.
Have you seen Richard?
He's upstairs throwing back whiskey like it's keeping him alive. We shared a look that was one part disdain, one part concern. We both remembered all too well what had happened the last time Richard drank too much.
What about Meredith? I asked, wondering if she might be a contributing factor to Richard's foul mood, or if James and Alexander and I were solely to blame.
Holding court in the garden, Colin said. She hung all the lights out there. I think she's watching to make sure no one tears them down.
Sounds about right.
He grinned.
Though we had originally compared him to Richard, the comparison didn't stick. He played the same bombastic roles, but offstage his cockiness was endearing more than infuriating.
"Want to come out for a smoke?" he said.
"I've had one, but you should find Pip in the yard."
"Great,"
he said, and stepped out after his friends. I turned to scan the kitchen, wondering where James had gotten to. For maybe an hour, maybe longer, I wandered from room to room, conversation to conversation, accepting drinks and congratulations with polite disinterest. The music in the dining room was so loud I could hardly hear what anyone said. The dull red light and constant surge and sway of bodies exacerbated my state of intoxication, and when I began to feel dizzy, I ventured out into the driveway. As soon as I set foot outside, the same flirtatious girl from Halloween spotted me. I did an abrupt 180 and escaped around the side of the building to the garden. The garden, less an actual garden than a small plot of grass bordered on three sides by trees, wasn't as crowded. People stood in clumps of three or four, talking and laughing or gazing up at the string lights, which had been painstakingly stretched from tree to tree. The yard twinkled as though several hundred obliging fireflies had decided to attend the party. Meredith sat on the table in the middle with her legs crossed at the knee, a drink in one hand and a toothpick speared through two olives in the other. She apparently was sipping martinis, while everyone else made do with well liquor and coke. I hovered uncertainly at the edge of the yard. We hadn't said more than a few words to each other since the dressing room incident, and I wasn't sure where we stood. Before long, I found myself staring at her legs. Her calves tapered perfectly to slender ankles and black pumps with 5-inch heels. I considered the possibility that she was sitting on the table because she couldn't stand on the soft ground without sinking into it. When she realized I was there, she smiled, without resentment, it seemed. The boy beside her, he played cello with the orchestral students, though I didn't know which year he was, carried on talking, unaware that her attention had shifted. A little ripple of relief went through me. She turned toward the cellist again, but looked down into her drink, stirring slowly with her olives. I was about to go back inside when I felt an arm slide around my waist.
"Hello, you,"
Wren said with the cuddly, kittenish affection she always displayed when she'd been drinking. She was wearing something pale green and floaty that made her look like Tinkerbell. I ruffled her hair. "Hello. Having a good time?"
"Splendid. Only Richard's being a snot."
"I'm shocked." Her nose crinkled as she frowned. She was still hugging me around the waist, and I wondered vaguely if she could stand up on her own.
"I don't know what's gotten into him," she said, with an edge of bitterness in her voice I hadn't heard before. "He's always been a bit of a pig, but now he's, I don't know, mean."
It was such an innocent word that I felt a twinge of something protective, big brotherish. I squeezed her against my side and said, "I don't know if mean does it justice."
"Why not?"
"I don't know. It's not just mean. It's sadistic. He's been battering us on stage. Opening night, he about busted my eardrum. Philippa's got a bruise the size of Australia, and James..." I stopped, belatedly remembering my promise to keep it to myself. My verbal and visual filters weren't working properly.
"What's he done to James?"
she demanded, with a kind of fearful uncertainty. She was trying to keep up, but the whiskey wouldn't let her. "I said I wouldn't tell anyone, but he'll tell you if you ask him." I thought of him twirling a strand of her hair, and it occurred to me that he'd do just about anything she asked him to. Something clenched uncomfortably in my chest. She frowned again. Her arms had gone loose around me as if she'd forgotten they were there.
"You know, he scares me sometimes."
"James?" I asked, bewildered. She shook her head.
"Richard, I'm afraid he'll really hurt someone, or himself. He's just reckless, you know?" It wasn't the word I would have chosen, but I nodded anyway.
You should tell him that. You're probably the only person he'd listen to.
Maybe. But it'll have to wait till morning. Right now, he's completely plastered.
Well, I said, if he's too drunk to stand up, this party might turn out okay. I had a strange sinking feeling just then. Richard, no matter how much he drank, had never been fully incapacitated by alcohol. It only made him more, if I used Wren's word, reckless.
Meredith slid off the table and excused herself from her admirers, of which there were four by that time. She crossed the yard with surprising steadiness, cocked her head, and said, "Aren't you too precious?" Up close and in my less than lucid state, I couldn't stop staring at her. She wore a snug black sheath, one shoulder bare, a strap of tiny jet beads glittering on the other. In those shoes, she was almost as tall as I was.
"The garden looks amazing, Mare," Wren said.
"Yes." She smiled up at the lights. "I hate to leave it. And I must lose two of the sweetest companions in the world." She winked. Her eyeshadow, dark plum purple, somehow made her eyes even greener.
"Where are you going?" Wren asked.
"Inside for another drink." She raised her empty cup.
"Refill?"
Wren hiccuped.
"I think I'm done."
"I think you are too," Meredith said, barely scolding, almost sisterly. She turned to me.
"Olive, Oliver?"
She raised her toothpick, one last olive speared on the end.
"You have it," I said, unable to suppress a smirk. "If I did, it would be cannibalism."
She gave me such a piercing look that my temperature shot up about 10 degrees, then bit the olive off the toothpick and disappeared inside. I watched her go and stared dumbly at the empty doorway until Wren spoke.
"She doesn't seem to be suffering much."
"What?"
"She and Rick are taking some time off," she said,
making quotation marks in the air with only one hand.
"I figured you knew."
No, I didn't.
"Her idea. He's not exactly pleased about it, but you know how he is. He won't apologize for anything."
She made a face.
"If he'd just swallowed his pride, she might have changed her mind."
"Oh."
She yawned, pressed the back of her hand to her mouth.
"What time is it?"
"Dunno," I said. "Late."
My own eyelids felt a little heavy.
"I'll go find out."
"I don't want to know."
She let go of me, pushing herself off my side to stand up straight.
"Okay, I won't tell you."
She petted my arm like I was a dog, then meandered up the steps, a bit of her skirt pinched between two fingers. The yard had mostly emptied during our conversation. People were either heading back inside or, I hoped, going home. I ventured out into the middle of our little clearing and closed my eyes. The night air was chilly, but it didn't bother me. It soothed my warm skin like a salve, rinsed the smoke from my lungs, evicted Meredith's velvet shadow from my head. When I opened my eyes, I was surprised to see a patch of blue between the dark treetops, a white sliver of moon grinning down at me. A sudden desire to see the whole sky urged me to take the trail down to the lake, but when I made to move, James's voice held me in place.
"Well shone, moon. Truly the moon shines with a good grace."
I turned to find him standing behind me, hands in his pockets. "Where have you been all night?"
"Honestly?"
"Yeah, honestly."
"I was making the rounds for a while, but I got overwhelmed and snuck upstairs to do some reading."
I laughed.
"You utter dork. What brought you back down?"
"Well, it's after midnight, and I can't disappoint Alexander."
By now, I doubt he even remembers telling us that.
"Probably not."
He tilted his head back to admire the sky.
It looks farther away when there's so little of it.
For a while we just stood there, faces upturned, not speaking. The noise from the castle was a dull rumble in the background, like the clamor of car engines on a road in the distance. An owl hooted softly somewhere. It occurred to me, for the first time, I think, how alone we were when the castle was empty, when there wasn't a party, when the other students were all half a mile away at the hall. It was just us, the seven of us, and the trees, and the sky, and the lake, and the moon, and, of course, Shakespeare. He lived with us like an eighth housemate, an older, wiser friend, perpetually out of sight but never out of mind, as if he had just left the room. Much is the force of heaven-bred poesy. There was a soft fizz of electricity. Meredith's lights flickered and went out. I looked back toward the castle in the deep gloom. The kitchen lights were on and the music audible, so I assumed we hadn't blown a fuse. Wonder what happened. James was not curious enough to tear his eyes away from the sky. Look, he said. With the lights out, we could see stars, tiny pinpricks of white scattered around the moon and glinting like sequins. The world was perfectly still for one precious instant. Then there was a crash, a shout, and something inside shattered. At first, neither of us moved. We stood staring at each other, hoping, silently, desperately, pointlessly, that someone had simply knocked a bottle off the counter, or slipped on the stairs, or some other clumsy, innocent thing. But before either of us could speak again, voices inside started screaming. "Richard," I said, my heart already in my throat. "I bet anything." We raced back toward the castle in as straight a line as we could manage. The door was hanging open, but people had blocked it completely, filled up the gap. James and I shoved them aside to get into the kitchen, where at least a dozen others had made a ring around the edge of the room. James broke through the circle first, knocking two second-year linguists out of his way. I wasn't sober enough to judge the distance and slammed into him when he stopped, but the close press of people kept both of us from falling over. The cellist who'd been talking to Meredith outside sat crumpled on the floor with one hand over his face, blood dribbling out between his fingers. Philippa crouched beside him, perched on her toes in a glittering mess of broken glass. Meredith and Wren stood facing Richard, and all three of them were shouting at once, their words overlapping and indistinguishable as music and laughter churned in from the next room. Alexander hovered in the doorway behind Richard, but he was leaning on Colin and in no condition to intervene, so James and I pushed forward to arbitrate. "What happened?" I asked, hollering to be heard over the racket. "Richard," Philippa said, giving him a dirty look over her shoulder. "Came downstairs and sucker-punched him." "What the hell? Why?" "He was watching the yard from the upstairs window."
"Everyone calm down," James ordered.
Wren fell silent, but Richard and Meredith ignored him.
"You're out of control," she yelled. "You need to be in a straitjacket."
"Well, maybe we could share one."
"This is not a fucking joke! You could have knocked his teeth out!"
The boy on the floor groaned and leaned forward, a long thread of blood and saliva hanging from his bottom lip. Philippa stood up swiftly and said,
"Yeah, I think he probably did. He needs to go to the infirmary."
"I'll take him," Colin said. He left Alexander leaning on the door jamb and gave Richard a wide berth as he came across the kitchen. He and I and Philippa got the cellist to his feet and draped his arm around Colin's shoulders. They weren't even out of the room before Richard and Meredith resumed their shouting match. Meredith:
"Are you happy now?"
Richard:
"Are you?"
"Both of you, stop!"
Wren's voice had climbed to a dangerously high pitch.
"Just stop, can't you?"
Richard rounded on her, and she took one wary step back.
This isn't your problem, Ren.
No, Philippa said sharply. You've made it everybody's problem.
Don't be a bitch, Philippa.
James and I both moved forward, but Meredith spoke first and Richard froze, all the muscles between his shoulders bunched and bulging.
Don't talk to her like that. Turn around and look at me, she said. Stop bullying everyone else like a fucking schoolboy and look at me.
He turned and lurched toward her so suddenly that everyone jumped back, but Meredith didn't move an inch. She was either brave or crazy.
Shut your mouth, he started,
but she didn't let him finish.
Or what? You'll knock my teeth out too? She asked. Do it. I dare you.
I decided that perhaps brave and crazy were not mutually exclusive.
Meredith, I said carefully.
Richard swung toward me, and James and Philippa shifted closer, closing ranks.
Don't tempt me, he said. You, I'll send to the infirmary in pieces.
Back off!
Meredith shoved him, both hands hitting his chest with a flat thump. Before she could withdraw again, he grabbed her by the wrist.
It's not about him. You're making it about him because you can't hit me and you're just desperate to hit someone.
You'd like that, wouldn't you?
Richard said, jerking her forward. She twisted her arm against his grip until her flesh went white.
If I knocked you around a bit, gave everyone something to stare at. We all know how you like everyone staring at you, you slut.
Between the six of us, we'd called Meredith some version of slut 1,000 times, but this was horrifically different. Everything seemed to go silent, despite the music pounding in the next room. Richard grabbed her chin, tilting her face up toward his.
Well, it was fun for a while.
My last thin thread of hesitation snapped. I lunged at him, but Meredith was closer. People screamed as she backhanded him across the face. It was nothing like Camilo's class, not precise or controlled, but a wild, savage blow meant to do as much damage as possible. Richard swore obscenely, but before he could get to her, James and Alexander crashed into him like a pair of linebackers. Even their combined weight wasn't enough to knock him down, and he kept bellowing curses, snatching at every inch of Meredith he could reach. I grabbed her around the waist, but he already had a fistful of her hair, and she cried out in pain as he yanked on it. I lifted her right off the ground and wrenched her away from him, crushing her against my chest as I lost my balance and stumbled into Philippa. Richard, James, and Alexander pitched backward and fell against the cabinets, half a dozen people rushing to catch them before they hit the floor. I pawed Meredith's hair away from my face, one arm locked tight around her, unsure whether I was trying to protect her or control her or both. Meredith, I said, but she elbowed me in the stomach and shoved me off. Philippa seized my shirt when I staggered and held on, like she was afraid of what I might do if she let go. Meredith stared straight past us at Richard, arms rigid at her sides, chest heaving. Slowly he pushed himself upright. James had already backed away, and the few people still holding on to Richard hastily removed their hands. Alexander swore softly, touching his fingertips to a bloody lip. Everyone else's eyes were fixed on Meredith, but it wasn't the kind of staring she was used to. Everything she felt was written on her face. Shame, fury, paralytic disbelief.
You bastard, she said.
She turned and shouldered past me and Philippa, scattering terrified first years as she made her way to the stairs. Richard and I stood facing each other like unarmed fencers. Alexander flickered in my peripheral vision, reaching up for a napkin to wipe his mouth. I could hear Ren whimpering, but the sound was distant. James stood behind Richard like a shadow, watching me with a shell-shocked expression, one part dread, one part indignation. Anger bristled on my skin, trapped there by the fabric of my shirt pulled tight against my body.
I wanted to hurt Richard like he'd hurt Meredith, like he'd hurt James, like he would hurt any one of us who gave him half a reason. I glanced at Philippa because I didn't trust myself not to attack him any more than she did. "I'll go," I said stiffly. She nodded and let go of my shirt, and I didn't wait. The crowd parted as easily from me as it had from Meredith. I turned into the hall between the kitchen and dining room and pressed my back flat against the wall, breathing slowly through my nose until my head stopped spinning. I didn't even know what I was drunk on anymore. Whiskey and weed and howling rage. I took one last long breath, then ducked through the doorway to the stairwell. "Meredith," I said for the third time. She was the only one there, halfway up the stairs. Music droned in the walls, half-muted. Warm pink light leaked in from the kitchen.
"Leave me alone."
"Hey," I climbed the first three steps behind her. "Wait." She stopped, one hand trembling on the banister.
"For what? I'm done with this fucking party, with all of them down there. What do you want?"
"I just want to help."
"Is that right?"
I stared up at her, dress disheveled, arms folded, face flushed, and felt a tiny, painful thud in the pit of my stomach. She was too stubborn. "Forget it," I said, and turned down the stairs again.
"Oliver!"
I gritted my teeth, turned back around. "Yes?" She didn't say anything at first, just glared at me. Her hair was tangled and caught in her earring where Richard had grabbed it. That little rip in the middle of me opened wider and it burned, raw and tender, red and angry.
"You really want to help?" she asked.
It was only half a question. Tentative, suspicious of the answer. "Yes," I said again, too fiercely, stung by her doubt. That same brazen, fearless look she'd given me in the dressing room flashed across her face. In one impulsive motion, she came down the three steps between us and kissed me, caught me, both hands curled tight around the back of my neck. I was startled, but still, oblivious to everything but the unexpected heat of her mouth on mine. We separated an inch and looked at each other with wide, unguarded eyes. Nothing about her had ever seemed simple, but she was then. Simple and close and beautiful. A little tousled, a little damaged. We kissed again, more urgently. She forced my lips apart, stole my breath right out of my mouth, pushed me backward until I hit the banister. I grabbed her hips and pulled her against me, ready to feel every inch of her. An unfamiliar voice interrupted the thick noise of music through the wall. "Oh, shit." She disengaged, broke away, and I nearly lost my balance in the sudden absence of her body. Some nameless first year was standing at the foot of the stairs, drink in hand. His eyes slid from me to Meredith with dull, unfocused surprise. "Oh, shit," he said again, and staggered out toward the kitchen. Meredith reached for my hand.
"My room," she said.
I would have followed her anywhere, and I didn't care who knew, Richard, who deserved so much worse than such petty betrayal, or anyone else. We climbed the stairs hastily, clumsily, impeded by her high heels, my drunkenness, and our foolish refusal to keep our hands off each other. We ran down the hall on the second floor, crashing against the wall and locking lips again before we stumbled into her bedroom. She threw the door shut and turned the bolt behind her. We collided more than embraced. The whole feverish scene shot through with flashes of pain. She clenched her fingers in my hair, caught my bottom lip between her teeth, shuddered when the rough stubble on my jaw scraped her throat. The bass from the dining room downstairs thudded under everything like some savage tribal drumbeat. "You look fucking amazing," I said in the split second I had to speak when she pulled my shirt up over my head. She tossed it across the room.
Yeah, I know.
The fact that she knew was somehow sexier than pretending she didn't. I fumbled for the zipper on the side of her dress and said,
Great, just making sure.
The rest of our clothes came off and were carelessly discarded, everything but our underwear and Meredith's shoes. We kissed and gasped and grasped at each other like we were afraid to let go. My head swam, the floor shifting and tilting under me whenever I closed my eyes. I ran one hand from the nape of her neck to the small of her back, her skin electric under my fingertips. The warm silk touch of her lips against my ear made me groan and clutch her closer, delirious, addicted, furious that I'd ever pretended not to want her. We were halfway to the bed when a fist boomed on the door, made it shake in its frame. Another fist followed, and another, pounding and pounding like a battering ram.
Open the door! Open this fucking door!
Richard!
I reeled back, but Meredith grabbed me fast around the neck.
He can bang on the door all night if he wants.
He'll break it down, I said, and the words disappeared between her lips before they even left mine, the thought forgotten before I finished it. My pulse was wild.
Let him try.
She shoved me backward onto the bed, and I didn't argue. Everything after that was disjointed and confused. Richard hammered on the door, bellowing curses and threats I could barely hear, his voice only part of a heavy rhythm.
I'll kill you. I'll kill you. I swear to God, I'll kill you both.
It was impossible to listen with Meredith between me and him. Tangible, intoxicating, the tiny intake of her breath enough to drown out his riot of noise. He faded out like the end of a bad song, and I didn't know whether he'd left or I'd gone deaf to everything but Meredith. My head was so light that without her weight on top of me, I might have floated away. Inch by inch, my brain and body reconnected. I let her have her way for a little longer, then rolled her over on her back and pinned her down, unwilling to be entirely submissive. When I collapsed beside her on the mattress, my muscles were quivering under my skin. We were too hot to touch by then, and we lay with only our legs tangled together. Our shallow breaths lengthened, deepened, and sleep pulled me swiftly down like gravity. Scene 9. I didn't sleep long, and I slept like a man on a raft, waves rolling underneath me, seasick more than drunk. My eyes opened before I even knew I was awake, and I stared up at the unfamiliar ceiling. Meredith lay beside me, one hand pressed under her cheek, the other arm tucked tight against her chest. A tiny line had appeared between her eyebrows as though whatever she was dreaming troubled her. The lamp on the nightstand leaked watery orange light across the bed. I reached carefully over her to turn it off, but paused, my arm outstretched. Meredith's breath fluttered against the back of my hand. I couldn't help staring, not, for once, because she was beautiful, but because the small dark spots on her body I'd mistaken in my drunken fervor for shadows and tricks of the light hadn't faded. The delicate line of her wrist was marred by tiny blooms of purple, like budding violets on her skin. Older marks, weak as watercolors now, showed where a heavier hand than mine had touched her, where phantom fingers had squeezed too hard. The nape of her neck, the curve of her knee. She was every bit as bruised as James. I felt nauseous, but the sick feeling settled in my chest instead of my stomach. I risked brushing a strand of hair off her cheek, then turned the light out. The room shrank in around me, the eager darkness encroaching at last. I lifted the sheet and put my feet on the floor. I wanted water, badly, to soothe my dry throat and clear my head. Halfway across the room, I pulled my underwear on.
Before I opened the door, I pressed my ear against it. Was Richard crazy enough to wait outside all night for one of us to emerge? Hearing nothing, I opened it just a crack. The hall stretched empty and dark in both directions. The lights and music downstairs had been shut off, and the whole building felt skeletal, like an empty shell where some soft, spineless creature used to live. I crept toward the bathroom, wondering if I was the only person awake. Evidently not. Alexander's door was open, his bed empty. I moved quietly, hoping not to rouse anyone. I knew a confrontation of some kind was unavoidable, but I didn't want to face it any sooner than I had to. Not before I could convince myself that it had all actually happened. My memory of the party had the gauzy, chimerical quality of a dream. Part of me wanted to believe that was all it was. Assuming an inebriated partygoer had left the light on, I opened the bathroom door without knocking. In the instant it took my eyes to adjust, a crouching figure sprang up from the floor.
Jesus! Hush, Oliver, it's me.
James reached around me to pull the door shut. His arm brushed across my bare stomach, and I shivered at the dampness of his skin. He took one step back, naked and dripping wet. The shower drummed softly in the background.
What are you doing?
He pushed the toilet handle down, and the water swirled away as he wiped his mouth.
Just been sick, he said. You okay?
Yeah.
Drank too much is all. What are you doing up?
Needed some water, I said, averting my eyes.
We'd shared a room for 3 years, and James naked was nothing I hadn't seen before, but I'd surprised him, and it felt somehow intrusive.
Do you care if I get back in?
His hand rose briefly from his side, a loose, abortive gesture toward the shower.
I feel disgusting. I hate vomiting.
Go ahead.
I slid past him to get to the sink and cupped cold water into my mouth as he stepped over the side of the tub. The spray hit his skin with a hiss, and he pulled the curtain halfway closed.
So, he said a little too casually, did you just come from Meredith's room?
Yeah.
You think that's a good idea?
Not especially.
My reflection was messy, disheveled. I surreptitiously wiped a smear of lipstick from the corner of my mouth. In the mirror, I could see James leaning on the shower wall, water dripping from his nose and chin. I guess everyone knows, I said. I splashed my face, hoping my skin would cool.
One of the first years came in from the stairwell and basically announced it to the room.
I really hate first years.
I shut the faucet off, then closed the toilet lid and sat on it.
So? How was it?
I glanced up at him, anxiety prickling sorely on my skin.
You do know Richard's going to kill me.
That did seem to be his plan.
James turned his face into the water, eyes squeezed shut. My limbs felt heavy and useless, as if the muscles and bones had dissolved and been replaced with half-mixed concrete. I raked my wet fingers through my hair and asked,
"Where is he, anyway?"
"Dunno. Disappeared into the woods with a bottle of scotch after Pip and Alexander stopped him kicking Meredith's door down."
"Christ."
I hung my head for a moment, then pushed myself to my feet before I felt too heavy to move.
"Are you going back to her room?"
James asked. His back was to me, the water slithering down between his shoulder blades in two narrow streams. For a moment, I indulged the idea that maybe it would wash his bruises off like paint. "I don't want to just leave her in there, like a one-night stand."
"Is that not what this is?"
I couldn't remember ever being angry with James before. The feeling surged up unexpectedly, broad and vulnerable, raw as a burn. "No," I said too loudly. He glanced over his shoulder, brow furrowed in confusion.
"Oh?"
"Look, I know she's not your favorite,
but she's not just some girl either. He blinked.
I guess not,
he said, and turned his back to me again. James, I said, with no idea what I meant to say after. He turned the water off, one hand lingering on the handle. A few tiny drops clung to his eyelashes, rolled down his face like tears.
What?
He said, slightly delayed. I struggled to form words. I felt the shape of them, but not the substance, until a smudge on his cheek distracted me. You've got puke on your face, I blurted. His expression was blank as the odd sentence registered, and when it did, he blushed to the roots of his hair.
Oh.
Suddenly we were both embarrassed, which seemed absurd, after the last 5 minutes of intimate conversation and casual nakedness.
I'm sorry, that's vile, he said.
It's fine. I stooped down to grab his towel from the floor. Here. We'd both reached for it, and when I stood up again, we nearly bumped heads. I eased back, enormously aware of my own body and how clumsy it was. He looked wide awake, almost alarmed. I felt my own face going hot. I garbled a good night, put the towel in his hand, and hastily left the room. Scene 10. An hour or so later, I woke again to the sound of someone banging on the door. There was a voice, too. Female. Not Richard. I propped myself halfway up and Meredith stirred beside me. Whoever it was knocked again, more insistently.
Oliver, I know you're in there, Philippa said. Get up.
She sounded hollow, like a bad recording of herself. I didn't want her to wake Meredith, so I slid out of the bed and opened the door without bothering to find my jeans. Philippa's face was drawn and pale.
Get dressed, she said. Both of you. You need to come down to the dock, now.
She left, walking quickly, head bent. I stood in the doorway for a moment, surprised by her failure to make some scathing remark. Something was wrong. Wrong enough that my waking up déshabillé in Meredith's room didn't matter. I closed the door again and began grabbing my clothes off the floor.
Meredith, I said urgently, wake up.
We went down to the dock together, bleary-eyed and puzzled.
What the fuck is going on? She asked. It's not even light out.
I don't know, I said. Philippa seemed upset.
About what?
She didn't say. We stumbled down the rickety wooden stairs built into the side of the hill in partial darkness. A soft, muffled cold, like a blanket of snow, pressed in around me and made me shiver, even though I'd pulled a coat and a sweatshirt on. The steps were littered with rocks and twigs, and the danger of stumbling was so great that I kept my eyes on my feet until the last step finally flattened out and I glanced up. A few stubborn stars still peered down from a sky barely lighter than the jagged black branches of the trees. I paused as my eyes adjusted to the sunless, twilit world. Shadow shapes solidified as James, Alexander, Wren, and Philippa, all standing there on the dock, staring out at the water. I couldn't see past them, see what it was they were looking at.
What is it? I said. Guys?
Alexander was the only one to turn my way, and he just shook his head, a tiny, labored motion.
What's going on? Meredith said.
There was finally a note of worry in her voice. I pushed between James and Wren, and the vast expanse of the lake opened up in front of me, mist blurring the lines of the banks. Tiny ripples murmured around a grotesque pale shape, partly submerged where the water should have been glassy and smooth. Richard floated on his back, neck twisted unnaturally, mouth gaping, face frozen in a Greek mask of agony. Blood crawled dark and sticky across his face from the crush of tissue and bone that used to be an eye socket, a cheekbone, now cracked and broken open like an eggshell. We stood numb and silent on the dock as the earth ceased to turn. A terrible stillness held our six warm, breathing bodies and Richard, unmoving, inanimate thing, in the same unbreakable thrall. Then there was a sound, a soft groan. Richard stretched one hand feebly toward us, and the whole world lurched. Wren stifled a scream, and James grabbed my arm.
"Oh, God!" He choked on the word. "He's still alive!"
Act 3. Prologue. Colborne and I emerge into the early afternoon together. The day feels primeval, prehistoric, the sun bright and blinding behind a thin layer of clouds. Neither of us has sunglasses, and we grimace against the light like reluctant newborn babies.
"Where to now?"
he says. "I'd like to walk around the lake." I start across the lawn, and he walks close beside me. Mostly, he's been silent, just listening. Every now and then, his face responds to something I've said, a subtle lift of the eyebrows or a twitch at the corner of his mouth. He's asked a few questions, little things like,
"This was when?"
Though the timeline is clear in my head, explaining it to someone else is a curious task. Simple in theory, but painstaking in practice, like assembling a long line of dominoes. One event inevitably leads to the next. We walk all the way down to the woods without speaking. The trees are taller than I remember. I don't have to duck under the branches anymore. I wonder how much a tree grows in 10 years and reach out to brush the bark as if each knotted trunk is the shoulder of an old friend I touch as I pass without thinking. I reconsider. I don't have any old friends except Philippa. How do the others think of me now? I haven't seen them. I don't know. We emerge from the copse onto the beach, which looks exactly the same. Coarse white sand like salt, rows and rows of weather-beaten benches. The little shed where James poured blood all over me on Halloween is listing slightly to the side, a diminutive Tower of Pisa. Colborne's hands hide in his pockets as he looks out over the water. We can see the opposite shore just barely, a hazy line drawn between the trees and their reflections. The tower sticks up out of the forest like a fairy tale turret. I count three across to find the window that was beside my bed, a narrow black slot in the gray stone wall.
"Was it cold that night?" Colborne says. "I don't remember."
"Cold enough." I wonder if there's still a clear patch of sky over the garden, or if the branches have all tangled together to block it out. At least I think it was. We'd all been drinking, and we always drank way too much, like it was something we were just supposed to do. The cult of excess. Drink and drugs, sex and love, pride and envy and revenge. Nothing in moderation. He shakes his head.
"Every Friday night I lie awake wondering what dumb thing some drunk kid's going to do that I'll have to clean up in the morning."
"Not anymore."
"Yeah. Just got my own kids to worry about."
"How old are they now?"
14, he says, like he can't quite believe it. "Starting high school this fall."
"They'll be all right," I tell him.
"How do you know?"
"They've got better parents than we did." He smirks, not quite sure whether I might be mocking him. Then he nods toward the castle.
"You want to walk around to the south bank?"
"Not yet." I sit down in the sand and peer up at him. "This is a long story. There's a lot you don't know yet."
"I've got all day."
You going to stand until nightfall? He makes a face, but bends his knees to sit beside me as a breeze blows off the lake.
So, he says, how much of what you told me about that night was true?
All of it, I say, in one way or another. A pause.
Are we going to play this game?
Wherein I am false, I am honest. Not true, to be true, I say.
I thought they would have beaten that bullshit out of you in prison.
That bullshit is all that kept me going. One thing I'm sure Colborne will never understand is that I need language to live, like food. Lexemes and morphemes and morsels of meaning nourish me with the knowledge that, yes, there is a word for this. Someone else has felt it before.
Why don't you just tell me what happened? No performance, no poetics.
For us, everything was a performance. A small private smile catches me off guard and I glance down, hoping he won't see it. Everything poetic. Colborne is quiet for a moment and then says,
"You win. Tell it your way."
I gaze across the lake at the top of the tower. A large bird, a hawk maybe, soars in long, lazy circles over the trees, an elegant black boomerang against the silvery sky. The party started around 11. We were all wrecked by 1 o'clock. Richard, worst of all. He broke a glass, punched a kid in the mouth. Things got ugly and confused and out of control, and by 2, I was upstairs in bed with Meredith. I can feel his eyes on the side of my face, but I don't look up.
"That was the truth?"
he asks, and I sigh, exasperated by the note of surprise in his voice. Weren't there enough witnesses?
20 shit-faced kids at a party, and only one of them actually saw anything.
Well, he wasn't blind.
So there was something between you two.
Yes, I say. There was something. I don't know how to continue. Of course, I was at Meredith's mercy. Like Aphrodite, she demanded exaltation and idolatry. But what was her weakness for me, tame and inconsequential as I was? A thing of mystery. As I tell the story to Colborne, guilt wriggles worm-like in the pit of my stomach. Our relationship was a point of significant interest, but Meredith refused to testify at my trial, stubbornly insisting that she didn't remember what everyone wanted to know. She spent a few weeks being hounded by press people, which proved to be too much attention even for her. After I was convicted, she went back to the Manhattan apartment and, for a month or so, didn't come out. Her brother Caleb made the news before she did, when he broke a paparazzo's jaw with his briefcase. After that, the vultures lost interest, and I thought of Caleb more fondly. Meredith did eventually make her way to TV. She stars now in some legal drama loosely based on the Henry VI cycle. It was popular in prison, not because of its Shakespearean source material, but because she spends a lot of time on the show lounging around in slinky nightgowns that show off her figure. She came to visit me, only once, and when the rumor that I'd had some sort of affair with her surfaced, it won me unprecedented respect among the other inmates. If pressed for details, I told them only what could be found on the internet or was obvious, that she was a natural redhead, had a small birthmark on her hip, wasn't shy about sex. The more intimate truths I kept to myself, that our lovemaking was as sweet as it was savage, that despite her normally foul mouth, the only noise she ever made in bed was to murmur, "Oh God, Oliver," in my ear, that we might have even loved each other for a minute or two. I give Colborne only the trivial details.
"You know, she came to see me one night," he says, digging his heels into the sand. "Rang the bell until it woke us up, and when I opened the door, she was standing there on the porch in this ridiculous dress, glittering like a Christmas tree."
He almost laughs.
I thought I was dreaming. She barged in and said she needed to talk to me, said it couldn't wait, that there was a party on, and it was the only time you all wouldn't miss her.
When was this?
The same week we arrested you. Friday, I think.
So that's where she went.
He glances at me, and I shrug. I did miss her.
We lapse into silence, or as close to silence as we can get, with the distant cries of birds, the murmur of the wind between the pine needles, the tiny wash of waves licking at the shore. The story has changed. We both feel it. It happens just like it did 10 years ago. We find Richard in the water, and we know nothing will ever be the same.